It is so wonderful to not only have Stone Cold Steve Austin here with us, ladies and gentlemen. He was on our very first show. It's so wonderful to be here in our highly technical studio here in rural Oklahoma. Steve, how you doing?
Oh, another day at the office down here in Los Angeles, California. The weather was kind of it's kind of gray. Got a marine layer hanging over my part of the neighborhood in Los Angeles. So I love it when it's like this. I'm having a great day. Hershey the Wonder Dog is sleeping right next to me, and I'm drinking a cup of coffee, ready to open up a can on your show.
Audio whip ass. That's what you do.
There you go, brother.
Steve's on podcast one every Tuesday and Thursday. He has two shows drop a week. Us here on the Ross Report, we do this thing every Wednesday. So that's our story, and we're sticking to it. What we had Steve on our very first show, as I mentioned, and we just talked about a lot of stuff that was really WrestleMania oriented. It didn't start out to really be intended to be a WrestleMania show, but we had a WrestleMania theme. And to finish, I want to finish the WrestleMania theme with a couple questions, and I got this list here. Where does the WrestleMania 13 with you and Brett, that would be Bret Hart for you newcomers, where does that match rank in your, you know, top whatever of WrestleMania matches? Is it top five? Is it top three?
You talking about WrestleMania in general or my WrestleMania matches?
Your match, your opponents, where did the match with Bret rank with the other guys that you work with at other WrestleManias?
Oh, man, I tell you what, you know, I had some clashes with The Rock, and that guy was just, you know, they call him most electrifying man in sports entertainment. And for some reason, you know, The Rock and I just clicked on every single cylinder. I was good for him, and he was good for me. But when you talk about Bret Hart, WrestleMania 13, you talk about how important that match was for my career, also executing the double turn in the business, high-profile match on the biggest stage in a semi-main match, which blew the main out of the water with all due respect to those two cats.
Yeah.
Man, that, you can't beat WrestleMania 13. That iconic image of Stone Cold passing out in the pool of blood with the sharpshooter. It was just two guys who went out there, and we thought we were going to stake the joint out. I'm not a submission wrestler. I only know about three damn holds, and it was a kick in the gut and a drop, you know, a stunner.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, we went out there, and I, man, at that time, I owned Chicago. Chicago was my town. It was my favorite town to work in, and I tell you what, it was a special night, and everything worked.
It did.
WrestleMania 13, Bret the Hitman Hart, one of the greatest of all time, and that match right there specifically, probably the greatest match I ever had.
Really? I kept thinking, you know, well, I've called most of Steve's matches, you know, over the years. I had a couple of interruptions in service when I was sick of the Bell's palsy a couple of times, and I don't think I was ever future endeavored while you were there, I don't believe.
I couldn't remember. I mean, hell, WWE has fired just as damn many times.
Yeah,
I didn't know what was going on.
There you go. I don't know either. I don't know. I didn't know then. I didn't know when I was there what was going on. So just ask anybody I work with. They'll tell you. the match with Bret, considering where it propelled you, considering that he really, there's a torch passing right there. Now, we talked the last time about the fact that neither of us wanted to see The Undertaker lose at WrestleMania. That was not the torch to be passed. The Bret Hart going to the villain side and leaving the All-American, not All-American, All-Canadian guy side, that was big business. Because he was as popular as anybody in the territory. And he's going to become a heel. And then you have been a heel. The double turn worked like magic, but man, it really puts you in that left lane where you could drive as fast as you wanted, because that was the break, it seemed to me like.
Yeah, and that was the break. You know, still a lot of work to be done on the backside of that to propel me forward, but that was certainly a key moment. And, you know, Bret Hart gave it his all that match. He really brought his A game, which, you know, seemingly every time I saw Bret Hart in a squared circle, he gave it everything he got. One of my most favorite competitors to work against or with, and just in general, as far as a body of work, Bret Hart is in my top three of just, if I can only watch Bret Hart matches, I'm fine with that because I like the story that he told.
Yeah.
I like style and his execution, his flow, everything that he did worked for me.
Yeah, he understood. He got it. And he told great stories. And, you know, he had to fight. Last time we talked, I asked you, hey, if you were the WWE booker of the territory, you know, eyebrows up here, tongue in cheek, but seriously about the booking, would you have a problem making Daniel Bryan the WWE World Champion? You said no. Well, you know, Bret Hart is a lot bigger than Daniel Bryan, and Bret Hart at one time was considered, he and Shawn Michaels both, too small for the top title. And I think one of the smartest things that WWE ever did strategically was to downsize a little bit and get guys like Shawn and Bret as the focal point of the promotion, because it changed the dynamic and the perception of the WWE, in my opinion, when those two guys were champions.
Well, you also got to look at it like this. I mean, back in the day, you know, when they first started, you know, letting Bret run with that belt, and then Shawn, they were small guys, but that was because the top guys were all 300 plus pounds. Almost the entire roster was 300 pounders, right?
Right. Yeah.
We look at all the big bodies. So
too much.
Yeah,
too
and
big.
Then all of a sudden, you know, those guys got their break, and all of a sudden, you know, it was a win-win for the fans because, you know, it was great to see the big guys do their thing, and everybody wants to see the heavyweights clash. But when it comes down to watching a hellacious back and forth match, that's going to go down to, you know, those middle sized guys, you know, a size category that I put myself in: Ric Flair, Bret Hart, Shawn Michaels,
right?
You know, Kurt Hennig, Randy Savage. I mean, you know, you can keep going on and on with those kind of guys. You know, The Rock, you can go out there and deliver that match back and forth, pacing, pro style, but with, you know, bursts and exclamation points and not just that one speed type stuff.
Well, you know, I always thought that and speaking of what you're talking about, that, you know, the real smart bookers would protect guys that, let's say you brought a Kevin Nash into the territory. Well, you wouldn't have three or four more 7-footers in the territory. Just wouldn't do it.
If you had one more 7-footer, maybe you'd make them a tag team. Or you'd feud them together, and then that'd be it. Yeah, he's got to be special.
Yeah, and that's just the way that it's a matter. It has nothing to do with prejudice for somebody that's listening. It has everything to do with casting, because you're talking about casting a entertainment program, a TV show that is an entertainment entity. So yeah, we do the old time guys, and I still do it. I still think of it this way. They booked it, you know. But bookers were cast. They were casting agents. They were producers. They were directors. They were writers. They did all those things. So all it was the casting, in my humble opinion. And we just it was cast different. All of a sudden, the premium went on the guys that could really get it on. You know, you hear so much. I don't think I've ever heard anybody talk about, before I came to WWE, the most famous match that guys in the locker room would talk about in WWE annals was Steamboat and Savage at WrestleMania 3. The boys weren't overly impressed with anything else. Now, they didn't hate everything, and they were glad guys were making money, and they wished they were on Hogan's cards, because if you were on Hogan's cards, you made more money on your payoff because he sold more tickets. That was a gimme. But as far as the working in the ring and that great performance, there was one match that really stood out, and that was Steamboat and Savage. And then all of a sudden in WWE around the mid-90s and moving forward to 2000, all of a sudden that whole work rate picked up, where you didn't see that great match every now and then. You saw it on a regular basis.
Yeah, but it also helps. I mean, like when you talk about the Savage Steamboat match, you know, if those had been two unknowns that would have went out there and had that match, it would have been a great mechanical match.
It'd been a great second or third match.
Yeah, I mean, it would have been a great match. But the fact that it was Savage and Steamboat who were over.
Yeah.
Made, and the fact that it was that match and those are the two guys in it, the fact that they were over to the degree that they were, you know, that just made it, you know, one of the best all-time matches, you know, in the history of the business. So, you know, it was funny because back in the days in the old dirt sheets, and everybody started talking about work rate. Yeah, work rate is fine if it means something. If it just means you're a buzzsaw out there doing a bunch of stuff in the ring and not gauging accordingly or doing listening to the crowd,
you're trying
to listen to response. It's not just action for the sake of action. Everything still has to mean something.
I used to tell people, Steve had a unique ability to tell you what he did not like. And sometimes he couldn't tell you for sure why he didn't like it. And more often than not, he didn't have a concrete solution, but he could just, his instincts told him, this ain't right for me. And is that fairly accurate?
Yeah, you know, one time someone said, Triple H buried me in an interview when I'd show up to creative or show up to Monday Night Raw and I just say, well, I don't like that. That ain't worth a damn. I ain't going to do it. And people thought he was knocking me. He wasn't knocking me. That was the truth. And I jazzed it up with a little bit more salt and pepper on language. I was very, vocal about, no, I was not going to do that because it sucked. And I didn't have an alternative plan. And that's the thing when you're dealing with, you know, any kind of problem, but specifically with Vince McMahon, if you don't like anything, it's okay to shoot something done, but have an alternate plan that you're willing to offer up to help solve the problem at hand. And so we can get into Monday Night Raw. So many times, man, I'd show up and say, no, I ain't doing that. And they could look in my eyes and they knew that they weren't going to talk me into doing anything I didn't want to do. So that's just the way it was.
Where is the original Smoking Skull belt?
In my safe.
Oh, so you got it.
I got it.
Oh, that damn guy.
I got the Intercontinental belt, that I won back from Owen the night I got dropped on my head there in East Rutherford, New Jersey.
Yeah.
I got the, old Winged Eagle belt that Sean had. I won from him at 14 with the broken side off of it there in the safe. I've got a couple of those things. I got the old world television title from, WCW.
Really?
In my safe. I've got a safe here, Fort Knox safe, best safe in the world. It's full of championship belts.
That's pretty cool. That is very cool. Hey, it's funny how the TV title used to really mean something in some promotions, isn't it?
It is.
The TV title down south was kind of the equivalent to the Intercontinental title in WWF at the time. The guy
who's going to kill somebody can work your ass off.
Yeah.
And make somebody look good and hang over that belt.
Yeah, 10 minutes, 15 minutes. And I wrote about this the other day in a blog, and I guess it just reinforces that I'm an old fart, but you know, I don't, because you take away time limits off all matches, unless there's a special occasion. So you eliminate all time limits. It reeks of showbiz oozing out of every crack of the ring because no sporting event, that I'm aware of, I'm sure there probably are, has a time limit.
Right.
Of some kind, right? I mean, so by doing this, you eliminate a draw. Now, if I told you that Steve, I think that occasionally, me and you, let's say we're writing TV, and I say, I think that we can have the occasional draw. Would you think I was crazy?
Oh, yeah, I would.
So you think that people now are so accustomed to even a non-finish
non-finish, DQ, something like that.
Well, all I'm saying is that I don't know, the rules are so lax that what do you got to do to get disqualified? Because,
well, let's go back in time a little bit. Let's go back to the Royal Rumble where, Brock Lesnar came down the ring. Big Show was already there and started shellacking him with a steel chair. Now, back in the old days, they would have sent down 10, 15 refs. Okay, and even before that, Jack Tunney would have come down and restored order. And, you know, might have even, you know, just called off the match to begin with.
Right.
But anyway, poor Mike Chioda was put in a real tough spot. And I love Mike Chioda. He's a hell of a damn ref. But, you know, nobody came down. He's trying to stop Brock Lesnar. And then all of a sudden, he just kind of asks Big Show if he's okay. Then he starts the match.
It was a disconnect. The match was a disconnect because how do you allow a competitor A with a weapon to beat up competitor B and still have the match? I miss it because in the old days, number one, Big Show, who was the fan favorite, would have had allies. Somebody in the back that was a fan favorite, a baby face, would have had enough compassion to come out there and stop this this travesty.
You would figure that he had one friend back.
Back
in the old days, man, guys would run out and help their brothers out.
Yeah, and
I guess old Big Show has alienated everybody in that dressing room, and it didn't have a friend one back there that's gonna come help him out, or they were scared of Brock Lesnar.
Yeah, and there wasn't.
And he is a force to reckon with. I'll say that.
Oh yeah, no doubt about that. There wasn't an abundance of referees there for that deal either, as I recall. But nonetheless, I just believe this. I believe that two skilled workers can have a 10-minute match with a time limit on television, and occasionally it's a draw, and you're not gonna have an uprising or a revolt.
No, I'm okay with the time limit draw.
So and now we can't have a time limit draw because why?
Right.
We got no time limits.
Right.
So now you've just taken one of your logical, believable, whether you're a hardcore fan or a casual fan, a logical finish has now been completely eliminated from consideration. And I don't get that. That's like, it doesn't make sense to me. I'm an old guy. I'd like to see you could have a draw. I think you'd have a draw now and then. It's not a bad thing. Let me ask you this question. Back when I remember booking you in live events, when you really started rocking and rolling, and I would get pressured from Vince to put you in tags because, you know, you are so valuable and, everybody's got an expiration date, some sort of DNA on them. We don't know when it is exactly. We just hope we can guess good and stay ahead of the curve, but everybody's got an expiration date. So he wanted me to book you in tags a lot on the live events. And I remember doing that. And I don't know, you got a booking sheet of TV, but of course, like, half the guys there, you didn't look at it, you know, which is fine. So you get to the town. I remember calling the office, Friday Town, and I was still at work probably around 6 or 7 o'clock. And you want to know why you were booked in a tag. And I explained why you're booked in a tag and that, you know, Vince thought it was best for you. You know, pace yourself. And man, you were hotter than hell. You were mad. And so I said, well, can we get through tonight and let me get a chance to fix it by tomorrow? And you reluctantly did it. I don't even remember who you were teaming with. It might have been Taker. I don't know. Could have been. I don't know who it was. It was another top guy. It wasn't like it wasn't you and Howard Finkel against Harvey Whippleman and, you know, Sid Vicious. It was a top guy. But what was your issue about the not liking the tags? Because people are going to say, well, God, Steve and Brian Pillman were a great team as the Hollywood Blondes. I always said, well, it's a different place, a different time.
Well, you're right. It was a different place at a different time. And, you know, that's one of the big problems I had with tag team wrestling because, you know, if you're getting pushed as a tag and your partner goes down, he blows his knee out, man, there you go. Now you're on your own. You know, you've invested all this time together to build that team up. Now you kind of, you know, that's not a good situation to be in. So I always wanted to be self-reliant, and I loved tagging with Flying Brian Pillman and the Hollywood Blondes. So I loved every minute of that. I was mad when they split us up. So anyway, keep going into the future, back on the singles path, self-reliant, do my own thing. I didn't like tag matches just because, hey, I was a singles wrestler, so I wanted to be booked at singles matches. I understand, you know, the fact that, you know, take a little bit of the workload off of me by, you know, when you get in a tag match, theoretically, you're doing half as much work as you would have because you've got the other guys in the ring to help you and for the other guys to do their part and to put in that time and tell that story. But I just, you know, and I'm a fan of watching tag team wrestling.
Me
and
too.
I was a part of some great matches that I love being in. But when Stone Cold Steve Austin is coming down that ramp, the glass is broken. Here I come to the ring to open up a can of whoop ass. I want to do it by myself with some other cat, one on one in the ring with a badass referee.
Well, I sure had to, I'll apologize now for back. I don't remember what year it was.
Well, you know, the logic is sound. And I remember having those conversations with you guys a couple of those times.
Yeah.
And so, you know, yeah, obviously, and hey, man, you know, I was running hard and living hard. So I needed someone to help me take care of myself. I can admit that now.
Yeah, we wanted to do the right thing. But here's the deal. If it was going to cause more stress and more mental angst than it was going to help on the physical side, then we were sending good money after bad. Didn't make any sense. So that's why you stopped being booked as in tag matches. And when you were at at the top of the mountain, they got to see Stone Cold Steve Austin. Now, I had another, Vince and I had another issue, not an issue, but a philosophical discussion. He said, well, you ought to get Steve on early and get him out of there. Okay. Okay. Well, I knew where that was going to go. You're going to say, I've worked my ass off all my life to get here. I've worked hard to get in the main event. The main event goes on last. I'm going to go on last. So I didn't even bring it up. I didn't. Hey, every now and then I might bring it up just so I can cover myself with Vince. And I'd say, he said, well, did you talk to Steve about going on early? Yep. He didn't want to. He wanted to go on last. And he was very adamant about it. So I didn't push the issue.
Man, there was a couple of times when I did that because it was new to me. And I was like, hey, man, I don't know if this is a slap in the face or if it's to help me out. That number four spot and then intermission, then you take a shower and get your ass down the road to the next shot.
Yeah.
If it was double shot or whatever the scenario was to get on the road traveling. But, you know, man, I tell you what, you live to be in the main event. The main event is at the end of the show. I was talking to Dutch Mantel a while back. And, you know, sometimes the main event would go on number four because they had so much heat down there in Puerto Rico. They did it for the safety of the wrestlers to get their ass out of the building.
Yeah.
Because if you went on last, then people are going to wait outside.
They're waiting on you.
Probably try to kill you.
They're waiting on you. Exactly.
But anyway, from a performance standpoint, everybody in that dressing room wants to be the last guy in that ring. That's the bottom line.
Yeah.
Main event.
Yeah, I agree. Hey, hit me with these one or short answers on this word association thing. I'm just going to give you some names, just some different guys. Ricky Steamboat.
One of the greatest of all time, one of my favorite guys to work with, a guy who was instrumental in getting my chops up in WCW. Worked with him a million times, love him.
Great mentor. He was a great. He coached you up there, man.
Great fire. No, you don't have to tell Ricky nothing. I mean, we're going to do our thing, but he's going to do his thing. You grab Ricky in a headlock, he's going to top wrist lock. You know, he's always had a counter for everything. You didn't have to tell him to do nothing. He could work.
Yeah. Dusty Rhodes.
Oh, the American Dream, one of my favorite promos of all time. Went to high school with my mother, Austin, Texas. Me and his son, Dustin, born in the same hospital. The American Dream is one of my favorite pro wrestlers of all time. And I loved what he did. He was a big guy who could work his ass off. Some people say, hey, his work wasn't that great. Bull Corn. Dusty Rhodes was the most charismatic, great of a worker that was ever in the squared circle. Respect.
He drew money. I guarantee you that. He drew money and he could talk. Vince McMahon.
Crazy ass genius. I tell you what, you've been there through half my battles with Vince McMahon, Jim. And, you know, I tell you what, I love that guy. And he gave an opportunity and he listened to me when I had some ideas and I broke out. And then we started feuding. And out of all the people I've been in the ring with, just at a face-to-face level, he mirrors back exactly what I'm given. Just pure, flat out hatred energy for a human being in a combative or competitive element. And it's a work, but his intensity is so great I loved working with Vince McMahon. Now, we had our personal issues. At times, I hated his guts. At times, I hated the stuff that they did on TV when they was ribbing you on the square, and that really pissed me off. But I learned more of working with Vince McMahon than I did in 5 years of college. He's the greatest promoter in the history of the business, and I respect the living hell out of him.
Yeah, he's a genius. There's no doubt about it. And, I guarantee he's not Switzerland. He's not neutral.
That dude has guts. Yeah. He's got passion. He's got heart. He's got brains. And he'll go out on a damn limb. You ain't got to push Vince McMahon. He is a leader and not a follower.
Yeah, and I love his swagger. I want to live to be 68, and I want to live when I'm 68 to have the same drive. That son of a gun is the hardest working human being. I thought Bill Watts was a hard worker, and he was. He really was. I thought that Ted Turner was an amazing visionary when I knew him, and he was. But I haven't seen anybody come close to the work ethic of Vince McMahon. Now, you don't have to love, I didn't love every one of Walt Disney's movies. Some of the animated movies I thought was a little less than what I need to watch. Now, throw me a good old Davy Crockett out there, a little something, a little Yeller, kind of, I'm okay. But McMahon's a Disney. You may not like everything he's done, but you got to look at the theme park and look at this, what he's built, look at that thing he's built. Pretty damn impressive. Well, no one in our business will ever approach McMahon's accomplishments without question.
Oh, man, and look at what Monday Night Raw's done on television. Jesus Christ, the run that show has had. And the theme of my podcast, I do my podcast for the working man.
Yep.
I don't know anybody that works harder than Vince McMahon. So if he's driving around in a $200,000 Bentley and he's got a $20 million mansion there in Greenwich or whatever, that son of a buck earned every penny he's got. Bought the business from his dad,
Yep. Put
everybody else out of business, and it was all pure D hard work.
Absolutely.
I appreciate you having me on. I'll catch your ass down the road.
All right, Steve, thanks very much. You're just the best. That's all I can say. Stone Cold Steve Austin, ladies and gentlemen. So until next week, everybody, thank you very much for being with us. Have a wonderful week. Be good to others, and I'll talk to you again here next week on the Ross Report.